conquer and we're going to take some. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
That's what we're going to do, sweetheart. We are going to go and get some. Hey. All right, people, on the ready line. Yeah. Iron Lee!
Yeah!
Iron Lee!
Yeah!
Where are you?
The October transition and employment issue shares financial information, resources, and tips for helping to make the transition from high school to college or employment for students with disabilities as successful as possible. Read all for free at www.epmagazine.com.
Monotony. It comes in all shapes and sizes. Dull, tedious, just plain boring. But what is this? A contender, perhaps? Something unboring by the looks of it. Jabs right at dull, an uppercut to tedium, something that keeps you on your toes, keeps your head on a swivel, a knockout punch to your old boring workouts. Welcome to Fight Camp.
Oscar Mike Radio is a proud podcast partner of REITs Across America Radio, heard every Thursday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 8 a.m. Eastern. They're also big supporters of the nonprofit I Got Your Six, Two Lives at Once. And with every REIT you sponsor through Oscar Mike Radio, $5 goes back to this great organization dedicated to making a difference in the lives of veterans, law enforcement, firefighters, and first responders battling PTSD. Two Lives at Once pairs these brave men and women together with dogs rescued from kill shelters. In this way, two lives are saved at the same time by saving each other. Donate now. Go to reitsacrossamerica.org/OscarMikeRadio to help. That's reitsacrossamerica.org/OscarMikeRadio.
Marines are made for this. Made for the calling only warriors can answer. Made from an unshakable belief in our nation and a strength that comes from the determination to win together. But you'll have to earn your place among us, because you don't join the Marines. You become one.
Hello and welcome again to Oscar Mike Radio. My name is Travis, Marine Corps veteran and your host. Oscar Mike Radio is co-produced with Sinister One Productions. What's your podcast doing? I want to thank my sponsors, Joyce Asek of Asek Real Estate, Echo Six Creations, and my supporters, Kason Shaving Company, Exceptional Parent Magazine, and Fight Camp. Be your strongest combination. We're coming into the 250th birthday of the Marine Corps. And I'm very excited about that. But one of the things that we have to understand, and I certainly do as a Marine, is that it's not all ooh-rah and Semper Fi. There are some tragedies, some bad things that have happened in the time the Marine Corps has been in existence. And we can learn from that. We can learn a lot from that. And I'm pleased to introduce my next guest, author of the book Fuji Fire, Chaz Henry. Welcome to Oscar Mike Radio.
Thanks, Travis. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Really interesting how, again, I'm a Marine, I served in the Marine Corps, and how much I didn't know. I mean, I think it's for obvious reasons, but there's a lot of things that go on that you just don't know about. And I had never really heard of the Fuji Fire situation, incident, and all that until I got to read your book and do some history and dive in. And this is not just like a synopsis, like you've really delved into the reality of the situation, what happened and how this happened, because as my understanding, this was a peacetime event. So before we get into all that good stuff, kind of give me an introduction of who Mr. Henry, Mr. Chaz Henry is, and we'll start from there.
Sure. Well, like you, I'm a former Marine. I enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1975, went on active duty in 1976.
Wait a minute. Get out.
Seven years. Pardon me?
I was 3 years old when you went to the Marine Corps.
I call this the recent human problem. I'm meeting more and more people like that, and I'm also scrolling down. I get my birth year online.
Yeah, but you don't even scratch the surface of being what I think your age should be. Like you look very young.
Thank you. The Marine Corps, I guess.
I guess so.
The business habit, right?
I want some of what you have. So please continue. Thank you.
So was an enlisted Marine Corps journalist for 7.5 years. I traveled around Asia, East Africa, most of the Pacific, writing for the Marine Corps newspapers. I was based out of Hawaii with the 1st Marine Division, did 2 Western Pacific deployments, spent some time with the 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and from there, some time in Central America. And I was selected to become a warrant officer in the public affairs field. Did that, went to the basic school at Quantico, and then had the hellish assignment of Hollywood, California, where I was deputy director of the office that dealt with the motion picture industry. And I was there for about 3 years. It was very interesting. Heartbreak Ridge was the one film that we sort of contributed to during my time there. That's a wreck of renown. But then the Marine Corps sent me to college to finish my bachelor's degree. I had been going to school at night along the way, and they sent me to the University of Southern California, and I went to the film school there, actually, and graduated in 1989. And because of that, the Marine Corps sent me to Washington, D.C., and I went to work on a Navy television program. The Marine Corps wanted to get Marines on TV, but that's really expensive. Why don't we just send some Marines over to let the Navy pay for this? And so I worked on a television program called Navy News This Week, and we covered Navy and Marine Corps stories in the time I was there. And during that, I went up and set up a bureau in the Middle East during the first Gulf War, and I was able to go into Kuwait with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and shoot video on the movement toward taking the airport in Kuwait City. And I was selected then to become a limited duty officer. I was promoted from chief warrant officer cap to captain. I never had to be a lieutenant. So the Marine Corps saved me that. And I was stationed at Quantico, and I retired at 20 years in the Marine Corps from Quantico.
Nice. Let me just go back a little bit, because I only saw like the PR Marines like a couple times in my brief Marine Corps career, and they came out in their air-conditioned vehicle, got out with their little laptops, types and stuff, took some photos, got back in their air-conditioned vehicle, and went back to Mainside. You know, I was in Yuma, Arizona, so there was the Cannon Air Defense Complex about 7 miles away from the main air base. But then I talked to some of those some of the older, you know, PR Marines who told me that they literally had to hump a typewriter, you know, to some of their locations and type the story up and then send it by, you know, hand mail back to wherever is that true?
It's going back to, I had, given as my age, I had the privilege of meeting a lot of World War II combat correspondents.
Really?
And a couple of things came to mind. One, the equipment that they had. Well, when I first joined the Marine Corps, I was typing on a manual typewriter, but they had big, heavy equipment that they had to hump around. I did in some measure even in the 1980s when I was carrying video cameras, that gear was really pretty big. And in addition to a pack and a rifle and a pistol and everything, it was heavy. But you know, everything was tougher in the old Corps. I wish that I had some of the, you know, the small digital equipment that people have to work with today. But a lot of times things are easy. Sometimes they're not in that field.
All right. One more thing before we go into the book. So I had an Army, you know, staff NCO come up to me and said, you know, the World War II Pacific Theater was actually the best PR move the Marine Corps ever made. You would think that the Marine Corps was the only force there. Well, you all might have been the first ones in, but it was the Army that did all the heavy lifting and all the grunt work. It just seems like the Marine Corps was, because they got more PR money. I don't know. It seems like we were at all the hot spots. What do you think, sir? Is there any truth to that?
So I think you could maybe say something along those lines about World War I. In World War I, the Marines fought and they did exceptionally well. Many units of the Army did the same. The Marine Corps had a better public relations machine in World War I. In World War II, those Marines of World War II, I'm getting goosebumps as I say this, they earned the respect that a lot of us have found reflected on us wearing the Marine Corps uniform. I think the Marines of World War II, and you just look at the chronologies of the battles. You look at Peleliu, Iwo Jima, Okinawa. The Marines were in most often first and big. Army units did come in, and the Army units did experience fighting, but I think the Marines of World War II earned every bit, and a lot of us have maybe even undeservedly basked in that reflection. I have huge respect for the Marines of World War II. They earned every accolade that has come along.
Okay, sure. I mean, we always get the, I always get the beef from the Army that, hey, we actually did the biggest, amphibious landing in D-Day and not you all. I'm like, okay, just whatever. Fine, I'll give that to you. But I've interviewed another PR Marine. She served, recently, and I say recently in the last, 7 years. And it was a very interesting viewpoint into what the PR department of the Marine Corps actually does. So I was extremely interested to talk with you. And here's the thing, Chaz, there's a lot of stories in the Marine Corps, but I didn't know anything about Fuji Fire. So my first question is that by design? Because reading about it, and we'll get into it, it was like, I don't know if the Marine Corps really wants to talk about this. So what drew you to that? Why is that?
So I had been at Camp Fuji in 1978. I was
Okay.
on a Western Pacific deployment, and we offloaded. I think the ships needed to go do something. They just needed to get rid of the Marines. So we were at Camp Fuji for a month or two, and so I was familiar with Camp Fuji. So when I was back in Hawaii in October 1979, and this terrible tragedy occurred, and we heard about it, 73 injured, of whom 54 were burned and 13 died. It was a kick in the gut, and so I went on with the rest of my career thinking that this was sort of the general recognition of this event. Many years go by. So I retired from the Marine Corps in 1996 and I go to graduate school, and then I have a long career in journalism, 25 years, covering defense issues, veterans issues, that sort of thing. And I convinced my wife to retire. I'm going to retire from daily journalism and we're going to travel. Then the pandemic hits. So I'm looking for something to do, something to be productive, some way to be productive. And because of some health issues I'd had earlier, my immune system is suppressed. So I had to be sort of careful about being out and about. So I'm kind of stuck at home. So I'm posting old photos of myself on Facebook, and one of them is me at Camp Fuji. And I just mentioned in passing, this was taken about a year before the big fire there. And then I was shocked by the number of fellow Marines, even, much less anybody else, who asked what fire. Even Marines who I know had been through Camp Fuji in the 1980s. And it was just a shock to me. And then similarly, I was embarrassed to realize that a friend of mine, a guy I'd known since 1981, we met in the 2nd Marine Division, had escaped from a flaming hut at Camp Fuji, and I had never known that over all these years. And so I was really shocked at the number, how little so few people knew. And of course, it did beg the question, why is that? And that got me started investigating. And I started off thinking, well, maybe I'll put a podcast together or something. I just started doing research, seeing what I could find online. And that morphed into a 4-year, 2-continent project in which I interviewed more than 130 people who had been directly involved in the incident. If you'd like to go immediately to your question, why does no one know? I would say 75% of the reason is that 2 weeks after the fire, U.S. hostages were taken at the U.S. Embassy in Iran.
Okay.
It was a crisis that held America's attention for more than a year, the period when those hostages were held. And so what attention had been focused on the disaster at Camp Fuji just shifted and never came back. 25% I would attribute to the Marine Corps deciding, let's not talk about this because it might beg questions about how it happened. Even though the principal cause of the incident was a naturally occurring typhoon, still there were man-made decisions that allowed this tragedy to grow to the proportions that it did.
So just for everybody here who, and I'll have the link to Fuji Fire in the Oscar Mike Rio show post where you can purchase it. But for all of us out there watching and listening, What was the Fuji disaster?
So, October 19th, 1979, Typhoon Tip, which to this day holds the record of the largest and most intense typhoon ever recorded. Typhoon Tip had been ranging across the Pacific. It was massive. It comes up the southern part of Honshu, the main Japanese island, and moves up across the island and Camp Fuji, ramshackle little training camp that the Marines have occupied since the 1950s. It was part of land that was taken from the Japanese at the very end of World War II. The Army held it. In the 1950s, they gave Marines a portion. And the Marines would go up there and train. They'd come from Okinawa, where most of the Marines were stationed in the Pacific. And because in Okinawa, there was a lot of building up around bases, there were places where you couldn't fire artillery. You couldn't have tanks firing because the round may end up in a farm or in somebody's backyard. So there was a wide open space to train right at the base of Mount Fuji on the Kanto Plain. And so units would come up from Okinawa. They would spend maybe anywhere from a few weeks to a few months. And they could practice at the battalion size with Marines moving forward, tanks firing over their heads, artillery firing over, supporting their movement the way they would in combat. And so a unit from Okinawa, the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, had come up. They were in this training camp. The training camp was sort of in two parts. There was a large part at the top where these units that would come to train would live and work. And then there's a small, down the hill at the bottom, there's sort of a small camp where the people who ran the camp lived and worked. Shortly before 2-4 had gotten up there, a logistics unit had come in to help the battalion that had been there before. And they put their fuel farm, which were a number of rubberized fabric fuel bladders, some with gasoline, some with diesel, some with aviation fuel, uphill of this of where the barracks were, these Quonset
Yeah.
huts, these World War II era Quonset huts that had been brought in for the Marines to live in. It was old, it was ramshackle, it was run down, it was primitive, in one Marine's words. And even the commandant of the Marine Corps later said that he thought the camp looked as if it had been built by infantry carpenters. So they're in these Quonset huts that are heated by open flame kerosene heaters. Imagine sort of 55-gallon drum-looking things that you toss a match into and you close the door, and kerosene is fed on a line into the hut. And so these huts were very airy. They're not well sealed, but still yet, these things cranked out a lot of heat, and you could actually be comfortable in the Quonset huts. So they were getting ready to train, but then in 12, 15 hours before the storm comes, they get the word that storm is coming. Eventually, their training and at liberty that was going to come after that is canceled, and everybody goes into their huts to ride out the storm. The typhoon comes through. In a day, it dumps more rain than that area typically would get in a month. And so water is running in, wind is blowing doors open and shut. So some of the people take plywood and they nail it on the outside of some of the doors. Some people push wall lockers up against doors. The doors weren't doors like you and I think about. They were flimsy pieces of plywood that sort of fit in the hatch. And so they're in there riding out the storm. The entire training camp, this is the uphill portion, is sort of sloped. And in fact, it was tiered at four or five times. They had retaining walls because it was such a sloping ground. The fuel bladders were up the hill from the Quonset huts, and there was quite a large berm of volcanic soil in between that if you looked at it, you'd say, well, you know, if there was a fuel spill, that would contain it on one side and they would have a chance to clean it up. So much rain fell, water accumulated behind this on the uphill side of this berm, a breach was created. So this is maybe 15 to 20 feet wide, and this water just comes flowing through the breach, all this water that's been held uphill. It goes downhill, it floods the Quonset huts. There's 2 or 3 inches or more of water flowing in some and out the other door. Eventually, the water lifts the fuel bladder holding gasoline. Gasoline floats on top of water, it's lighter. The whole bladder is lifted up, and it's pulled into the breached portion of this berm. Hoses are all still connected to pumps on top of the berm, a couple of pumps each a ton and a half in weight. The pumps are pulled down into this breach. They have sharp edges, one of the sharp edges rips a 5-foot slice in one of the fuel bladders. 5,500 gallons of gasoline leaves the bladder, flows downhill on top of the water and into the huts. Vapors rise from that, and we have ignitions inside the huts. And then the ignitions, the gasoline burning, just continued to flow through the camp. And so over the course of an hour or so, fires moved from one hut to another. And there would be, as the erosion is creating sort of these rivulets of water with gasoline on top, flames are rising. So you have these 10 or 15-foot curtains of flame just moving through the camp. And people, as people become aware of this, they're trying to outrun them. They're trying to avoid that. The people who were in the huts that first ignited were those that were particularly most likely to either be burned when the ignition happened initially, or be burned as they ran out of their hut into these walls of flame.
Well, just reading your book, you talk about the burn victims and how, the officers came in to look at these Marines and they could not believe what they'd seen. They hadn't seen anything like that since Vietnam, and it really had an effect on them. And it just was like they were trying to figure out like how did this happen? Where were the breakdowns? And what could anything have been done to prevent this? Because you don't really point fingers in your book. You just state the facts. But, some people think that the Marine Corps could have done more in the base setup. Some people are like, this is just a weird act of God thing that really no one could prepare for.
Well, the act of God was the summation of the Marine Corps investigators who looked into it. Even the Commandant of the Marine Corps later, in an interview in 1991, said there were too many human factors. You couldn't just blame a deity. I tried to lay out the facts. It took me a long time to think of this as an investigation, but it really was. I gathered as many facts as I could from talking to individuals who had been there, going through documents, U.S. and Japanese documents, and comparing and contrasting. When I had a document that was then reinforced by something somebody said, or vice versa, or two people had the same recollection, two people that hadn't spoken in decades, that helped me put together what I think is a pretty reasonable, reliable chronology. I'm not a safety specialist, but it strikes me that there were a succession of things, and I refer to this sort of as a system accident. There were ways the Marine Corps operated bureaucratically. People would join a unit and they would stay only for 12 months, and they would leave exactly 12 months from when they arrived. So you had constant turnover. Every month you're turning over 1/12 of your unit. There's not a lot of time for guys to get to know each other, care about each other, learn to work well together. If you're running a camp and you're only there for 12 months, and maybe when you arrived, your predecessor wasn't even there, he'd already transferred, you have to sort of learn everything in a year. And you may not learn everything you need to know about the soil in your camp and what you can expect it to do or not do, how reliable it can be, or make investments in safety and reliability of facilities. So there are certainly questions of accountability that are raised. And I leave that to readers, and particularly Marines, who sort of have expectations of what I think this person should do in a certain situation like this, or shouldn't do, or to see if they, what their perception is of it. But I tried to lay out as many facts as I could confirm. And my principal goal was to tell these Marines' story, because I had an email the other day from a Marine who wasn't involved in the book. But he told me, because this hasn't been mentioned in our history any place, those of us who were there feel a bit ashamed. And it's almost as begging them to ask, did we do something wrong? Why has the Marine Corps not mentioned this? So, for instance, the Marine Corps Museum recently opened a wing that exhibits 1976 to the current day, and there's nothing about the Fuji fire there. And there's even a chronology in the of significant events inside the museum, and it's not noted on that. There were some people at the time. So, for instance, so having worked in public affairs in the Marine Corps, I have expectations of sort of, when you're going to talk about something, how you go about it. And Leatherneck Magazine, the magazine of the Marines since 1917, I think, never wrote an article about the Fuji fire. To my mind, that tells me that somebody decided that they didn't want to raise the issue. In the Okinawa Marine, for the couple of years after the fire, I saw a lot of articles about how safe Camp Fuji was now. And that told me that Marines on Okinawa were a little leery, when they were told, okay, we're going to deploy up there for a couple of months training because of what had happened. What I do know is that the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert Barrow, he took action that made a significant difference at the camp over years. Now, you could argue that maybe this was attention that should have been paid prior, but before he left office, this happened about 100 days after he became commandant. It's a 4-year term. Before he left office, there was a fire station on Camp Fuji. Prior, Camp Fuji had no internal firefighting capability.
Wow.
They relied entirely on Japanese firefighters. There was a Japanese military camp across the street, and then there was a town nearby, the town of Gotemba, that had a fire department. And when they were inspected, had a fire inspection before the fire that raised a lot of questions, they said, well, we have a handshake agreement with these firefighters. But they had never allowed these Japanese firefighters on the camp. So the firefighters had no idea what facilities were there, what they were made of, where water was available, where hazmat might be stored, the sort of things that as a firefighter you want to know because you can be more effective on arrival. And in the confusion of the crisis, they weren't told it was a fuel fire. So when they did show up, and they did show up very quickly, and they did a good job, the best they could, eventually containing the fire, they brought water to fight a gasoline fire. And you really don't want to do that because water just pushes the gasoline and spreads the fire. Eventually, between that and they had foam that they could have brought. They could have brought chemical trucks, but they weren't told. So all that to say, yes, there are questions of accountability that I leave to the reader.
So you've done this for a long time, but I still wonder, because I wouldn't consider myself a journalist, although I try to, follow the basic best practices of not becoming too attached to your story or let personal bias creep in. But this is the Marine Corps, an organization you've served for many years of your life. How did you stick to just the facts, ma'am? Just the facts.
My goal was to present something that I thought was due to the Marines and sailors who had been at Camp Fuji that day.
Okay.
So my loyalty is to fellow Marines. And realizing that their story had not been told, and the more I learned about what they had endured and what the families of Marines who lost had in, were lost had endured and such, that was my North Star. And so my goal was to create as credible as possible a reconstruction of the events, finding every possible source I could from Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps archives, U.S. archives, the National Archives, Library of Congress, the Japanese National Archives, and the Japanese legislature's library. And I thought that was my goal, was to do what I think should have been done prior for these Marines and sailors, so that fellow Marines and others could know what they had gone through.
Sure.
The fact that it happened in peacetime, as you note earlier, that whole period, some Marines from the 1980s say, people don't think about us because there wasn't a war going on at that time. And some have called themselves the lost Marines. But my goal and what kept me focused was doing this for fellow Marines. And as I look in retrospect, I sort of fell into this because of the pandemic. But in the rearview mirror, I think this is probably the most meaningful work I will have done in my professional life as a Marine or as a journalist. And I was prepared for it because of my 20 years in the Marine Corps, my exposure to Camp Fuji and many other places, and the Marine Corps institutionally, knowing how it works. And then grad school studying national security policy and learning research skills, and then 25 years as a Marine and developing sources, and then retiring from that, I had the skill set that makes me think maybe that was all for this. Because, and then suddenly I have this time because of the pandemic. It's been very rewarding, and I felt that it was meaningful work that I could do for fellow Marines.
Well, I just got really choked up in a way when I started reading about the burn victims lying there in the bed trying to come to grips with what had happened to them and what life would be like, and some of the severe disfigurement they went through. And it was a very different post-service situation back then. The VA wasn't as mature as it was now, and we were in peacetime. And it really brought home that these were living human beings who had, through no fault of their own, suffered this. You alluded to that you had talked to several people who had been through this. Did you get a chance to talk to many of the burn victims or just a couple? How did that work in your collection of information?
So I'll tell you how I found people, and this was the biggest challenge of the project. And I'll get back to the so thinking of people who were seriously burned, probably 8 or 10. I
Oh, wow.
probably interviewed 8 or 10 guys who had suffered really serious burns of the 130 people that I interviewed all told. One of the first documents that I found when I started doing online research was a copy of the investigation into what had happened that was posted on the Navy JAG website. I don't know if it is any longer, but when I started in the year 2000 looking at this, on the JAG website, they had sort of a, I don't want to call it greatest hits, but they had about 8 or 10 investigations linked on their website. And I think these were sort of the most requested. And one of them was the Camp Fuji fire investigation. So I downloaded that. But it was highly redacted. A lot of stuff crossed out to include everyone's name. But again, another thing that makes me think this is meant to be, a couple months into the project, there was a mutual friend, my friend who was with 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, who escaped the hut in the fire, was in Beirut with another mutual friend of ours, who Charles W. Henderson, the author who wrote Marine Sniper and a number of other really well-selling books, had in 1986 done a FOIA request thinking he might write something about the Fuji fire. And he'd gotten a mostly non-redacted copy of the investigation. He could never interest a publisher, so he had about, three quarters of an inch of photocopied material that had been a result of his Freedom of Information Act request. He sent that to me and said, "Here, see if this helps." Well, between the two investigation copies, I was able to do a page-by-page reconstruction. And interestingly, some things that had been redacted in his weren't in the new one. I ended up with an almost entirely non-redacted investigation copy. And so, of course, that was useful in seeing the work of the investigators. But the biggest advantage it gave me was finding people. I saw names, and not everybody was named Fred Smith or John Jones. People had sufficiently unique names that I was able to use some of these people search engines on online, and I would find, I would have a name, and I would find maybe five people who might be that person. I'd send off five postal letters. So my wife gave me a hard time about how much I was spending on stamps, but it was worth it over time. I got in touch with more and more people. In some cases, they say, "Well, I'm still in touch with my buddy so and so," and eventually that turned into 130 people. And it, the interesting thing, I thought I was writing a book for people who had never heard about the Fuji fire. I said, "I'll put this together. People who have never heard of it will understand it." What I've subsequently come to learn is that everybody who was involved, from the Air Force storm chasers who flew into Typhoon Tip and recorded the lowest sea level air pressure ever recorded on Earth to this day, to the Marines who were at the camp who were terribly burned, to those who escaped the flames, to the medical people who followed at, Air Force and Army medical people, Navy medical people who cared for them. Everybody's experience of this was incredibly intense, but also very narrow. Just this short period of time. And a comment I've gotten from almost everybody has been, "It was really interesting to realize what was happening, before and after or around me as this was happening." And that's been as gratifying to know that it's a service that I've been able to be of even the people who experienced this terrible tragedy.
How did all your, it goes without saying, you've been in this business for a long time, but specifically, how did your Marine Corps experience covering other situations help you, aid you, guide you with this one?
Well, you have expectations about who does what in
Of
certain
course.
circumstances, and how people are expected to react, sort of expectations that you have of how people are supposed to react. And in many ways, this was as the sergeant major of 2-4 put it was every bit as much as like an incoming rocket attack. It was an attack. These were natural elements, but so the Marines had to react as they would have been trained in combat. So there were many inspirational cases of people stepping up and doing what was required. There, you had to make it up as you go. There's confusion because you haven't really planned or trained for an event specifically like this. They weren't resourced for a mass casualty exercise. So the Navy doctor, the one Navy doctor with the battalion and the 30 corpsmen, had some limited experience with burn injuries, but not a lot. Nor did they have a lot of the sort of medicines and bandages and stuff that you would need, particularly when you talk about an event on this scale. So there was a great deal of inspiration of and in some cases maybe a little disappointment at people reacting in a way that I would have expected more in that instance.
Just out of curiosity, as we move along, did the Marine Corps look at, sanction, or bless this book before it was published?
No, so I'm still curious. I've heard from the Marine Corps Safety Division, where someone has read the book and they're interested in possibly writing an article to talk about this as a case study in safety. But no, I dealt with the Marine Corps Archive when I was doing research. I spent a lot of time at Quantico and the Marine Corps Archives, but I had no contact with public affairs people. And in some respects, I thought, am I going to reach a point where there's a little pushback? The sad thing is, nobody remembers this. And so if there were people who thought it was untoward and might push back, it's so little known. And that was a bit sad in and of itself. I'm hoping that sufficient time has gone by. The circumstances that we're in now, the Marine Corps I retired from was so different from the Marine Corps I joined with regard to resources, starting with pay and benefits and the equipment that we had to work with. And just in so many ways, it was different. So it's hard to do exactly an apples and apples comparison to the military today to the military back then. Post-Vietnam, resources were limited. As defense budgets had been drawn down, the American public had very little appetite for a war, and also maybe even putting money into a defense force. And so I tried to keep that in mind, and as I thought about how much money the Marine Corps would have had to put into making the camp more robust. But the Marine Corps was able to do it afterwards when when their mind was put to it. So.
Well, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about the Camp Lejeune water situation and the most recent ones where the Osprey stories that have come out over the years. I mean, when I was in, there was a big crash in '96 of the Osprey, and the Marine Corps has managed that successfully. There's a lot of people still apprehensive about the Osprey. And then the Camp Lejeune was sad in its own way. And there's an element of through your book about safety and about making sure leadership knows what's going on. But could it happen again? Could this kind of thing happen again? Or are we in a situation now where it's social media is instantaneous with passing news? Lance Corporal can send a picture home to mom. Mom can pass it on to dad. Dad, mom get together. It goes to. So can it happen again, sir?
I don't think something like this could happen and be forgotten, certainly.
Okay.
And throughout this process, I kept thinking that, for instance, a couple of days after the fire, some guys collected money and they made some collect telephone calls back home. And Also, people were sending what were called Marsgrams at the time. People serving today won't know. You would fill out a piece of paper. It would go to one of the comm guys who would get in touch with ham radio operators across the United States. They would write down the message, put it in the mail. You would try to get to a radio operator near who you were sending a note to, your parents' home or whatever. And they would put it in the mail, and the letter would say, I'm okay, or, I've arrived here safely. So immediately after the fire, they sent out all these I'm okay messages. And then a couple of days later, a few people were able to make long distance phone calls, and they called home, and people had no idea what they were talking about. You're okay. What do you mean? What's wrong? Even though there were reports on a couple of network news organizations, ABC and CBS News had short TV reports on the Friday that it happened, and CBS had one more the following Monday. But there wasn't a lot of coverage, and with no social media, so not only did people back home not know what was going on, after the scores of horribly injured were taken to the U.S. to the Army Burn Center in San Antonio, the guys left back at the camp had no clue what happened to their buddies, and the guys it took a long time for guys in San Antonio to be able to write, healed to the point where they could write letters, and so some might get back. And then everybody's rotating every 12 months, people rotating. So a lot of people were left without a lot of information. And that, I don't think we would experience that now. And given the attention that social media would bring to something like that, I think that attention would, institutional attention would be placed on it more quickly. You mentioned the Camp Lejeune water situation. I was there in 1981 to 1984. And I remember how good that drinking fountain water tasted after going out running in the humidity in North Carolina. So I drank a lot of water. I had some health issues later in life that I can't say I know that they're attributable to that. But a lesson that I learned from it is that as Marines, you're expected to love the Marine Corps. And I think people in other services maybe can't understand this, but it's inculcated into you that you have to love the Marine Corps. What you end up loving really are your fellow Marines, and that nothing changes with that. But when I started getting mail letters from that had the banner Camp Lejeune Historic Water, almost as if it's this artisanal, bottled water that I'm pitching you as a means, because we don't want to say like poison water. Let's come up. I learned the lesson that humans love and institution can't love. It's just and it's, so it's foolhardy for me to expect an institution to love, even though it's full of individuals that with whom we share this common very strong bond. And so that came to mind. That epiphany came to mind as I was looking at this 1979 issue. And what I found was, I found a commandant who deeply cared, General Barrow, and the book speaks to how he was impacted personally by this. And there, in ways that I think were pretty, not just him saying I was impacted, but I think what I heard from other people, to include families of injured Marines themselves, the message that the general put out to the whole Marine Corps when this first happened. You can imagine what that message might be like today, if one was put out at all. What that message that, and I could, it took me forever to find it. I couldn't find it because the subject line was unexpected. Services of prayer for Camp Fuji victims. He put out a message to the entire Marine Corps calling, he said, everybody, and I'm paraphrasing, but saying, I believe that if we all pray at the same time, it can, a positive outcome can result. And it's probably not something that we would see today, but it was, and just, anyway, it was watching his reaction, the actions he took, was inspiring. And you recall from the book, I hadn't as a, I retired as a captain. I didn't, you talk about general level leadership. I've never really understood what, I can understand operating as an at operational level, but what does a general do? And if a general leads generals, what he did after that, he told every general in the Marine Corps, if you're crossing the United States, you stop in San Antonio, you visit those Marines, and you ask yourself, how did this happen? And that struck me, wow, I think that's general
Brilliant.
leadership.
Nothing happens in a vacuum. What What did it take from you to write this book? You mean you did it during COVID as something to do, but creativity does come at a cost. Like this energy doesn't happen in a vacuum. What did it take out of you to finally complete this and see it through to what it is now, Chaz?
Well, and you know this as a Marine, the reason those pain charts you get at the doctor's office 1 through 10 with a little smiley face or the frowny face, they don't work with Marines, because when you look at that chart, you look at the frowny face and you go, this is a guy with his leg blown off, or this is a guy with a sucking chest wound. And so compared to that, oh my gosh, I have no pain. So I can't compare anything that I went through. When I think about what the guys who experienced the Fuji fire endured, but there was an emotional weight to the topic. And so initially I was finding people the first year, year and a half, I'm just finding people. And then I'm recording interviews. But even that, even the first couple of years, I called my 2 years of crying with other men in their 60s, because in many cases, the guys I'm talking with said, because no one had heard of this, there was really nobody to talk about with it, because it was so, I don't want to say outrageous, but such heightened agony that, people would have no clue. They couldn't comprehend. So in many cases, guys are saying, I never even told my wife about this. But so I'm recording that. And there was an emotional weight. And then even after that, in the last couple of years, when I was mostly writing, I would be sitting, I worked in the front room here, and sitting on a love seat with my MacBook on my lap, and my wife would come in, and tears would be streaming down my face. And it's it, but as I say, there were some difficulties, but that motivated me on, because I'm thinking this has to be told. This, something of this weight can't be just left to, let's not talk about it anymore, as we've done for these 3 or 4 decades.
So last couple of questions here. What was the reaction from some of the survivors when they read your book, or if they have?
So it's been very gratifying. The book has been difficult for some of them to read, and I tell people, take time with it. It's not something you're probably going to speed read through, and it's not a book that I can really say I hope you enjoy, because the harm that was done to people, the nature of bird injury, is so difficult. But there's a great deal of inspiration, I think, beneath that. But so people have told me, one former corpsman told me that, I'm writing to you now after 3 days of crying. But most that I have spoken with have appreciated the fact that this has been documented when it previously hadn't been.
Where can people get this book hardcover? Do you do signed copies? All that good stuff, Chaz.
Well, it's available any place you get books. So you can
Okay.
order it through Amazon, order it directly from the University of Nebraska Press, which published it. It's available in hardcover, as a Kindle. There's an audiobook. I don't have copies myself, so as I run into people, I'm happy to sign copies. But if people are interested, they could drop me a note through my website, and we'll see how I can arrange it. And I hope to be doing some talks around the country, at which we might run into each other.
Absolutely, absolutely. What is your website, Chaz?
ChazHenry.com, and this specific page is, and it's Chaz with an S, ChazHenry.com. / Fuji fire.
I learned so much. Like I'd read about, Grenada. I'd read about the bombing in Libya, the Osprey, other things that, have affected the Marine Corps as a whole over the last 40 years. But this is something new. It just reminds me how much I don't know. And yeah, I could definitely, at the conclusion of the book, get the idea that you wanted these Marines to be remembered. And some of them were, in fact, very brave, looking out for their fellow Marines, realizing that if they, could, they could save their lives. It was really touching in that regard. So I certainly enjoyed reading it. Thank you for sharing it with me.
I appreciate your letting more people know about it, Travis. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chaz Henry, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, captain of the Marine Corps, retired. He wrote the book Fuji Fire. I'll have the link to his website, a link to the book in the Ausbeck Radio show post. Thank you so much for joining me as we get ready for the Marine Corps' 250th birthday. Thank you very much, Chaz. As we say in Ausbeck Mike Radio, we are mission in flight.
The biggest fear Gold Star families have that their child will be forgotten.
We need to never forget freedom wasn't free.
It's the fact that they give us the life we have now. We should remember them and like give thanks to them.
If I can be a part of something today that's going to make the surviving family of any of these veterans, these heroes, feel better tomorrow, then it's worth it.
That one wreath symbolizes one family that was able to smile because of the generous donations.
To sponsor a wreath and honor a veteran, visit wreathsacrossamerica.org.
Thank you for listening and watching Oscar Mike Radio, where our active duty service members and veterans are in action and the mission is in flight. Oscar Mike Radio is an Oversized Load Co-Sinister One production. If you are a veteran or know a veteran who needs help, please dial 988 and press 1 for the Veterans Crisis Line.